enough is enough. I have had it with these monkey fighting goths on this Monday through Friday plane.
Welcome to episode 257 of Zombie
Takeout. Zombie Takeout!
Oh, sorry. Nice. The B-Movie and Cult Movie Podcast. I'm Uncle John.
And I'm Scotto.
Contrary to popular belief.
I just did an entire episode of Samuel L. Jackson.
I was going to say, contrary to popular belief, you're not Samuel L. Jackson. We couldn't quite get that good of a guest host. Oh, before we get started, now as I regain my composure, I have a couple corrections to make from last week. I got a couple things wrong. At one point, I referred to Nova as Luna. Not sure why. Actually, I think I know why. There's a guitar company called Luna, and there are characters named Luna in a couple of other franchises I like. So I think a couple of wires got crossed. I just used the name once.
I thought you were just into that Chicago furniture or floor company, you know, 773202. Luna. Anyway.
It's a local thing, apparently.
Yeah, it is.
Also, at one point I said Anthony C. Ferrante, the director, wrote the movie. That's not the case. I got confused because I remember reading when the first Sharknado came out that he'd come up with the idea. Either Syfy or Asylum said they wanted a movie with sharks in a storm, and he's the one who came up with Sharknado.
Oh, so he didn't have anything to do with the third one?
Well, no, he directed all three of them, but I extrapolated from him pitching the idea to him writing them. All three of them were actually written by Thunder Levin, who works for Asylum.
Oh, okay.
And this gets to an interesting thought, because I rewatched the first one over the weekend, just to kind of see if there was any trace of where they've come from, you know, or how they've gotten to be as good as they are.
Yeah.
And it is a lot better once you've seen two and three. You can kind of see the traces of what they were trying to do.
Okay.
But it's still a three for me.
Yeah.
And we're dealing with the same writer, same director, and same two or three lead actors, depending on the movie.
It's funny because I think the general public are not in with us. I mean, I think they have kind of they've started writing us off. You know, like the first one had all of the hype. The second one was just kind of like this, oh, we're going to see this thing now and, you know, live tweeted or whatever. And then the third one really did not have the same heat that the...
I think because the first one didn't deserve the hype. And so people don't understand that two and three do deserve the hype. They deserve the hype that the first one got.
True.
But I also think it was... At least my suspicion, that Syfy and Asylum kind of stepped back. You know, the first one was such a cultural phenomenon, made so much money, not necessarily, you know, didn't get the ratings, but, you know, in merchandising and all of that, it and just cultural cachet, it did so well that they were kind of willing to step back and let Ferrante and Levin just kind of run with it.
I mean, Syfy isn't really brought up in many other, you know, for many other things.
Right.
Except for maybe the Lamprey movie.
Well, this is kind of their bread and butter at this point. And Sharknado was definitely the turning of a corner. And my only explanation, because the first one had these kind of random dramatic moments, and it was very sort of conventional. You know, it was a very typical narrative.
Right.
I think they just, you know, let Ferrante and Levin take the gloves off and run with it, and they just said, you know, fuck the narrative, let's just have fun.
Right, yes, that is obviously what happened in that last one.
And, you know, it led to a much better product.
Yeah.
I just was very curious to see, you know, how that tremendous improvement happened, and I, you know, having gone back, I think that's it. Anyway, enough about Sharknado, and without any further ado, on to this week's movie, which is from 2001, Turbulence 3, Heavy Metal, continuing our Part 3 three-parter. Of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary. Sponsored by Rutger Hauer and Joe Mantegna. A paycheck's a paycheck.
And also brought to you by Pointless Metal Scans. You know, if it goes off, you actually need to do something else.
Maybe take it off and put it on the little tray.
Yeah, you know. So, we obviously have another September 10th movie.
Yes.
This was, I was like, probably the most glaring September 10th movie you can see.
Oh, yeah.
At least it was actually made before September 11th, unlike the Left Behind movie, which was actually made after it, yet still had the feel to it.
Right.
But anyway, we have what they called a death metal band.
Well, they said death rocker.
Death rocker.
Okay. And I looked it up, and death rock is actually a thing.
Okay. All right. I was very confused by that.
It's kind of a offshoot of punk with kind of like a psychobilly angle to it.
That wasn't what they were playing, though.
No. It's death rock is basically goth and punk. That's the combination.
Okay. All right. All right.
But still not what they were doing in the movie.
I could have sworn I heard the words death metal, though.
And no, I was they were like, referred to as a metal band fuck? At one point. Yeah.
But anyway, they decide they're to have their final concert, or was it even their final concert?
I don't think it was their final. I think You're it right. was just a big You're promotion.
Right. It was just a promotion that they were going to have a concert on an airplane. So
goths on a plane.
So they're going to have this concert with very limited seating on an airplane.
Well, I kind of got the impression it was more of like a raffle or a, you know, first come, first serve, very expensive kind of thing for the hardcore fans.
All right. And of course, it was going to be on this newfangled thing, the internet. They were going to broadcast it. It was going to be the highest rated webcast ever. Or even, I think they even said the first live webcast.
Okay, for 2001, that I'll believe.
I think I will too. Yeah, not much was going on. And this was like 2000, I think.
Oh yeah, it was probably filmed in 2000. Put out in 2001.
So, I mean, it could have been the biggest. I don't know.
YouTube could have been the first.
You know, very small potatoes back then.
YouTube didn't exist actually that till about 2005, 2006.
Oh, you're right. 10th anniversary wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. 2005, yeah. So it was actually, I think the webcast angle may have been a bit of science fiction. I don't think that was a thing in 2001.
And if you're wondering why I'm stalling with this plot summary, because there really isn't much to say. Yeah. The theatrics suddenly turn real, of course. The plane is pretty much hijacked by this cult, one of them masquerading as the lead singer of the band, and they talk to the FBI. The FBI, who has a rogue agent who decides to go out and bust a hacker in the middle of this, and
well, I kind of got the impression they were already working on that case when the plane thing happened.
Well, right, they were working on that case. She makes the bust as the plane thing happens. And then informs her superiors of the plane thing, despite 4 million people already watching it.
Yeah, online. happening live online. Yeah, you'd think they would already know.
Woo! But then again, you know, September 11th did happen a year after this, so maybe they don't know everything.
And this really felt like it was made in the early 90s, anyway.
Oh yeah, definitely. So then. Yeah, they fight to take the plane back and land it safely.
And they play on a trope that is so overdone that Airplane played on it.
Well, right. They try to land the plane safely with an amateur talked down by the hacker.
20 years before this, Airplane parodied that trope.
Right. It was very confusing to see somebody doing this without winking or being ironic that they were really going to do. It has to be the hacker. I can't. I'm the professional pilot, but I can't talk him down for some reason because he just doesn't have the same bond with me. And hilarity ensues.
Yeah. And it starts with the name of the death rocker. Slade Craven.
Yeah, motherfucker. There is already a Slade, motherfucker.
Well, yeah, which is undoubtedly where they got the name from.
Well, yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. It was probably a tribute.
And they mentioned at one point that he files his taxes as Slade Craven. Talk about living your gimmick. And they start with showing his fans at the airport. And I got a very trauma feel from that scene. And I'm sure it was not intentional.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how much of this movie was really intentionally bad and just bad.
Yeah. Particularly because Slade is a dead ringer for The Crow.
Oh, yeah. You know,
The exact same makeup.
So many people, I mean, there's been talk online about what they were trying to do. A lot of people say Marilyn Manson. A couple people brought up the dude from Cradle of Filth.
I was thinking Manson myself.
But yeah, Manson's the obvious one they were going with. I wouldn't think... although, if you're telling
me... Because Manson was huge like 3 or 4 years before this movie was made.
If you're telling me they really had an accurate genre of metal, and it wasn't death metal, because I couldn't get past that.
Well, yeah, he's not death metal. Actually, before I looked it up, I said he kind of sounds like a poppy version of Manson.
Yeah.
But death rock is a thing, at least the name of the genre. It is not what he was playing. He was playing Manson gone mainstream.
I've listened to death rock before, like the Necromancer. Okay. The Necromantics?
Okay. Sounds about right for that. The name sounds right for that genre.
I've even seen those guys live.
And then, once we get into that early scene where they show Slade and, as the Crow, and they show the fans in a very trauma-like way, we get a shot of the control room where they're broadcasting the concert. And probably one of the most unusual cinematography decisions I have ever seen. It's a conversation between the two people in the control room, and they start with close-ups on their mouths.
The whole
thing...
It was
just bizarre.
I mean, I know they paid some money for Rutger Hauer, and honestly, just the inclusion of him in this movie is going to give it an extra brain for me. But the whole thing of them doing like the pre-flight checklist and everything, what was the point of that?
To show that the fans were raucous and really into the music and couldn't shut up for 5 minutes so they could do the pre-flight check?
No, I'm talking about the pilots in the cockpit doing all the I understood the stewardess, the flight attendants, trying to control the natives.
Right.
That I got, but pilot and co-pilot.
I think they were maybe trying to get you to care about the pilot because he buys it about halfway through the movie.
But they were just doing like a routine check. There was no dialogue or anything.
There was a little dialogue about what do you think of their music and.
Okay, that was fine, and I don't even think that was a part of that scene. I think they cut away after that.
Oh,
like he said, he said, just think about your time for Vietnam. It was something that
it never ends.
Right, and then I think they cut to the flight attendants, and then they cut back with them. Checking each gauge. I'm like, what? Why are we doing this?
Killing time.
Yeah, exactly.
It was an hour 32. They needed filler.
They didn't really, though. I mean, that's easily a couple minutes that could have been trimmed with...
Yeah.
I think we just give Hauer some more lines, but...
Yeah.
I mean, you're setting up the guy to read the phone book, practically.
And then they had an odd little head fake that... It seemed like an obvious tip of the hat to, who's going to be the villain. When they show you the host and the camera operator interacting, and he just kind of, at the end of the scene, glares at the camera operator.
Oh.
I was sure he was going to be one of the villains.
Well, right. They do a nice job faking you out with who the villain is and who the good guys are going to be.
I was actually fairly surprised, except for the fake Slade, because I knew that from the description.
I almost don't want to ruin,
but the other two surprised me.
Yeah, because that was a pretty neat surprise in this.
Yeah.
And they don't pull off much else that's a surprise.
And I think Sharknado may have borrowed from this movie, because they do news as exposition early in the movie.
Yeah, that's kind of an old trope, though.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of any other examples, but okay. Because they're explaining all the technology behind the concert and how it's this big thing that, you know, only certain select people can go to and yada yada. And basically just setting the scene.
I don't know. I think it doesn't feel like something that's... I mean, I'm trying to think of other examples where you've heard, like, press talking about how... You could probably even go back to Citizen Kane.
Well, yeah, you have the classic spinning newspaper thing.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, is kind of the same gag. And the line of his fans was interesting, because it was kind of randomly punk, goth, and metal.
Right.
It was basically just grab as many people in studded leather as you possibly can find.
I think that was pretty obvious with the whole point of what they felt about the genre in itself.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of nondescript to them. It was just, you know, minor chords and loud guitars and leather. And it's all the same.
Oh, it's not the crow that Craven looked like.
Okay.
It was Antonio Banderas in Interview with the Revenge of the Vampire.
Okay, there's another one.
The crow he had, he was a little bit Joker.
Oh, okay, he had the lips and the eyes done, okay.
Yeah.
It's been a while. And I was thinking of Sting from the WCW in the makeup, but I didn't know if he had changed it from the crow.
But yeah, it was very unoriginal makeup.
Yeah, because Slade was just white face.
Yeah.
Oh, one thing I do have to give it credit for, the computer interfaces were actually very realistic for 2001. A lot of Visual Basic, a lot of, you know, overly animated backgrounds, way before we got tasteful with anything.
and wait, also, how did Slade's makeup not sweat off?
Because it's movie makeup. Simple as that.
All right.
Also, because you have this gag where there are two people in the makeup, supposedly, even though it's the same actor playing both roles. So they couldn't have the makeup off at one point, because then you might, you know, realize it's not the same guy, or, you know, they wanted to keep it as his identity as hidden as possible for the switch, I guess.
Well, I saw a chameleon lying in the sun.
Incidentally, for all of the annoying things in this movie, Craven's fans had to be the worst.
Oh, I don't know. Really? I think, I don't know, Sheffer to me was a lot more annoying.
Really? He didn't bother me that much. I've seen him in a lot of movies, so I'm kind of used to him. He's kind of the poor man's Christian Slater.
This middle-aged dude with the bandana.
Oh, yeah, the bandana was horrible.
A hacker, you know, yeah. It didn't make any sense. And then, like, the scene, which is why you don't work with people you're in a relationship with.
They were together at the time?
Yeah.
Gabriel Anwar plays the FBI agent that arrests him.
The scenes they're in together are terrible. Where she comes in...
Well, she was terrible throughout.
They've established that he's hacked into this system... Mm-hmm. And then she busts him, and he's like, wait, what is this about? Like, wait, you just said you've broken a law.
Yeah, well, he hacked in to watch a concert. I don't know if that was breaking federal law, but maybe in 2001 it was. They were tracking him for something else, I think.
Right.
But the headband thing, yeah, that bugged me. Every time I saw him, all I could think was, who do you think you are, Mike Muir?
Or Tommy Lee Jones from one of those Steven Seagal movies. It was just fucking terrible.
I see that kind of bandana. I just think suicidal tendencies.
Yeah.
Now, a big problem with the movie is, and you talked about those scenes, the tone is generally kind of all over the place. It's nice and tense when you're up in the plane, but then you get into those scenes and there's this weird tension because, you know, they were together at the time. That makes actually a lot of sense now. And you get to the scenes with Joe Mantegna, and those are just kind of... moderately paced, you know, cops talking to each other kind of scenes.
Right. It was kind of fun watching Joe Montana
just
muddle his way through this. I enjoyed that a lot, actually.
It was kind of a paychecks all around situation for him and Power.
That man will not turn money down.
Another role, Power, apparently.
No.
I mean, I've seen him take a few paycheck roles, but this is easily the most egregious.
This was a really easy paycheck for him because, yeah. I mean, he just sat the fucking cockpit.
Right. And he gets a nice monologue.
He did not leave that chair. And yeah, he had the nicest.
Well, he did
monologue.
Leave at one point to talk to one of the other villains.
Right, and then he so.
And then he went right back to the chair.
Right. And then, yeah, he had the nicest monologue of the movie.
Definitely the best part of the movie was his monologue.
Yeah.
There was also a really obvious stock footage alert, and I know I'm pulling that from MST, when the tower blows up. They show, you know, the tower at the...
It's a really funny effect. Yeah.
The tower at, I think it was where the... I don't know if it was where they started or where they were going.
That was the most thorough bombing I've ever seen of anything.
Well, there was, I think it was where they left from. There was a bomb there to kind of cover the tracks. And you see the inside of the tower, and there's some nice yelling and some nice flame effects and some, you know, stuff moving. And then they cut to this so obvious stock footage shot.
Right. Like these explosions with, like, the tower kind of in front of them. Mm-hmm. But, like, if you were just blowing up the tower, you would just... bomb the tower.
Yeah.
So they bombed all around the tower.
Yeah, they blew the entire structure into tiny little pieces.
Right.
Slight overkill.
It's ridiculous.
Now, how many tropes do you think were in this movie?
Oh, man. I was waiting for him to say, I've got to concentrate.
Yeah. We have the hacker. We've got the death metal band, or heavy metal tropes. We've got the cop tropes, you know, of not believing the subordinate officer. We also have the criminal turning out to be a good guy.
Of course, yeah.
And we have the Satanists. The hijackers were Satanists.
Well, yeah.
Who were trying to crash the plane into a church in eastern Kansas because it was supposedly a gateway to hell.
You know, come for the boredom, stay for the unholiness.
Mm-hmm. And they actually went for the talked down landing.
Oh.
Easily the biggest facepalm in the entire movie.
My notes, like, this was going great until the hacker said, I will.
Yeah. I almost feel like I should respect it for having the balls to go there and do that trope. And I would have if they had winked a second.
I don't know. I think it made it more enjoyable that they were really... I mean, it was just something like, I've just discovered this thing for the first time kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, really?
I will say, it got a bit better when Slade broke character. When he wasn't, you know, brooding death rock guy. He was kind of himself trying to, you know, fix the situation. It got a lot better.
Once they established... That wasn't the real Slade.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It got better.
And it was interesting seeing a fight between two characters played by the same actor. You know, that's something I haven't seen since, like, old 60s TV shows.
He just needed the golden pitchfork thing. Mm-hmm. Gun.
Yeah. Oh, and was anybody ever supposed to believe that the plane had actually crashed?
Oh, I don't know.
There's this thing when, you know, Slade has to land the plane, of course, with the hacker talking him down. And everything, all the communications...
Just let that sentence sink in for a bit.
Yeah. The Death Rocker has to land the plane while the hacker talks him down.
Because the hacker played a lot of flight simulators.
Yes. Yet he was never actually using the joystick.
No. And he would tell him to flip things as if, you know, oh yeah, you're just going to do that. And then, like, would say, it's that thing over there, and describe it what he's supposed to do.
Yeah. When they mentioned the flight simulator thing and they showed the joystick, I kind of figured, you know, it would be an interesting twist on it because he would be controlling it to some extent. No, he just played the tower operator who was talking him down, the old trope.
Well, yeah, I thought he was going to hack the plane.
Mm-hmm. Because they mostly do fly themselves,
yeah.
Except for landing and takeoff, of course. But no, it was the trope to the letter. And just as they're touching down, all the communications to the plane cut out. And there's this, you know, did they crash moment. It was so obvious that they didn't. I mean, it would have been a five brain if that was it.
They all died in a fiery wreck.
If they just crashed and that was the end of the movie.
You are right. This would have gotten a five brain if that happened. There's no doubt about it. Oh.
But no. It was just, of course, the obvious communications glitch, you know, and they come back and Slade's celebrating and
Yay.
Everybody in the cabin is cheering. And
Ewok dance, and
I was just waiting for the inflatable ramp to come out of the plane, because they missed that trope.
Well, they needed the inflatable autopilot, too.
Oh, yeah, of course. Now, just one bit of trivia. This was the last film released by Trimark Pictures. And I definitely remember Trimark from the 90s. And I thought there was some decent stuff under their belt. But no, there were a lot of kind of almost B, you know, mainstream, but not quite B movies.
Huh.
And apparently they were Lionsgate. They merged with Lionsgate. That's what it was.
Oh.
They didn't go out of business, per se. Although they should have after this. On to sequels and remakes.
On to sequels and remakes.
No sequels, thankfully, because this is the third sequel in the, I have to look up the name, Turbulence series. couldn't even remember the name of the series.
Now, what were the other two like?
The first one was actually a mainstream feature. It starred Lauren Holly, who was famous for about 10 minutes in the 90s because she was married to Jim Carrey. Two was called Fear of Flying. I don't remember anything about it. I think it got a theatrical release. I vaguely remember seeing ads.
Ah, I see. The first one had Ray Liotta.
Oh, yeah. Jennifer Beals was in the second one. I only know that because I watched this on YouTube, and that was the up next was the second one.
I don't even see Turbulence 2 on IMDb. Oh, there it is. But it like doesn't come up unless you actually enter it.
Yeah. So in the first one, we have Lauren Holly and Ray Liotta. And then Jennifer Beals, and then
Craig Sheffer again.
Craig Sheffer and Rutger Hauer Berringer. And Joe Mantegna.
Oh no, the second one, Tom Berenger.
Yeah, Tom Berenger was in the second one, yeah.
And Jennifer Beals.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that pretty much says it all for the series.
So they have absolutely nothing to do with each other.
No, they're just plain drunks.
Hijacks, yeah. And then after September 11th, it was like, hey, let's not do that again.
Yeah. Well, then this was the last film released by the studio, so they couldn't very well do that again, even if September 11th hadn't happened.
Right, who owns the rights? Why would you bother getting the rights to this? I mean...
Yeah. Obviously, no one should ever remake these films. Well, and nobody's going to because of September 11th, of course.
You think Asylum could remake this?
Oh, that would be amazing. Forget the rest of the series, because it doesn't matter. They're all standalone.
Yeah.
Asylum... remaking this would be a thing of beauty.
I mean, you'd have to get, you know, a Michael Hayes.
And of course, Manson would have a cameo. Manson in a cameo definitely. As a music critic, talking about how much the band sucks. All right, on to Brains.
On to Brains.
For a while...
Sorry. Robert Hayes.
Yes. For most of the movie, I was thinking of... You know, suggesting the title once again, because I've suggested this a number of times, Mediocrity the Movie. For most of it, it was a dead 2.5, boring, mediocre, but like I said, it got a little better toward the end. Rutger Hauer had a great monologue, so I'm going to go 3.
I had a lot of fun watching this. It's just such a train wreck. It's a 3-brain movie, but as I said, I'm giving it an extra brain because of Rutger Hauer.
All right.
4 brains.
And what have we learned?
Chekhov's rule even applies to live electrical wires.
And electric chairs.
And you're right, and electric chairs.
And I learned that I should really visit Eastern Kansas sometime.
Why?
All right, so until next time, we'll be finishing up our three-parter. I'm going to stumble on that one
Say
more time.
Say that fast. 3 times.
Yeah. With Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, also continuing our deal from the beginning of the year. I think that deal is going to run through the year.
Oh,
like,
yeah, definitely.
Past the end of the year.
Yeah.
Even if we just do the first 5. Until then, go to zombietakeout.com, check out the album art, the episode description, of course, the episode itself, which you're already listening to, links to find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and YouTube, links to subscribe via RSS and iTunes. Please leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. Also, if you enjoy the show, spread the word. Give us a little word of mouth. Of course, we appreciate all of the listeners we have, but more would be better.
We're up to 75 likes on Facebook. It would be really nice to get to 100, you know?
We have just about that many subscribers, at least as of about a week ago when I checked last. You also find the movie list, every movie we've reviewed so far, and every movie we're going to review, up through, well, Pro Wrestlers vs. Zombies, if we ever get it.
Maybe we will. Who knows?
Hopefully. the request form. If you've got a movie you'd like to hear us review, please leave it on the request form. We'll get to it. Oh, I forgot to mention, this was actually a request, but I couldn't find out who requested it, because it was before I'd cleared everything out of there the first time.
Oh.
And the master list of all of those requests was on my old computer.
But thank you so much for requesting it, whoever did it. Yes. It was a lot of fun.
And if you're listening, let us know, post on Facebook in the comments. Let us know who you are so we can credit you next time.
Right.
And of course, the recommendations list. This never had a chance.
I think it's a trade wreck I could recommend.
Okay, that's surprising. It's rare for you to go higher than me. You can also email us, zombietankout@gmail.com, or leave us a voicemail at 414-368-ZT01, or for the alphanumerically challenged.
You can go fuck yourself.
414-368-9861. Of course, always remember that you'll always be calling from the middle of Milwaukee, and until next time, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
Can I go now?
Sponsored by Rutger Hauer and Joe Mantegna. Is it Mantegna or Mantegna?
Mantegna, I believe.
Okay.